And welcome back to the program. You're listening to Sacred Space here on CJUM 101.5 FM out of Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. We're sitting here talking with Michael Tazarian. So, Michael, before the break, I wanted to ask, who started the Illuminati?
Well, you know, officially it started in 1776 with a guy called Adam Weishaupt, or Weishaupt, in Germany, in Bavaria. But, you know, my researches and the researches of other people show that the Illuminati is a much older organization. It's the same thing as with the Knights Templars. People think that the Knights Templars date, you know, from the era of the First Crusade. It's just that during the Crusade, they came out into the open more, because that was an era in which, you know, there was a lot of need for open organizations like the militia. So their identity was a little bit harder to hide at that time. It's just that, you know, sort of complicit historians then try to tell you that this was the birth of these organizations. It's absolutely ludicrous. Some of these organizations are very, very ancient. But Adam Weishaupt in 1776, along with a guy called Baron Nijg, they officially started this organization, and they had an official agenda. And they were actually called the Perfectibles before they were called the Illuminati. They called themselves the Perfectibles, and they had like five members in the beginning. But it turns out that they were going strong, and one of their they were sending secret messages to their colleagues in France by way of a horseback rider, you know, a messenger. And as fate would have it, that that messenger on horseback, a great storm came, and the messenger was actually struck by lightning before he left the borders of Bavaria, I believe. And so when he was brought in and his satchel was opened, all of these secret society documents were discovered, you see, by the authorities. And so the existence of Weishaupt's Illuminati was basically discovered, and it was brought to the attention of the King of Bavaria, and he had them their houses raided. And so it was out of the bag. And from that moment on, people thought that the Illuminati had been suppressed. But actually, Adam Weishaupt had got away. He actually escaped. And, you know, the order continued. But the most important aspect to remember is that this was not just the brainchild of some, you know, socialistic, humanitarian Adam Weishaupt, whose own brainchild was to, you know, found a secret society. He himself had been initiated by a man called Kolmer, K-O-L-M-E-R, 5 years before, in about 1771. Adam Weishaupt was initiated into an Egyptian secret society by this merchant, very wealthy merchant from Egypt. So it's actually it's people behind Adam Weishaupt. Now, Weishaupt himself was a Jesuit. So there's even a more controversial, you know, slant to the story. The Vatican, not the Vatican as Roman Catholics would understand it, but the Vatican within the Vatican, that means the secret controlling oligarchical families, you know, in an Italian context. These are people who would have also operated behind the Medicis and the Borgias and the Paduas and all of these, the Sforzas and all the families of Padua and Genoa, the rich black nobility families, the Ghibellines. There's all sorts of different oligarchical families that the world needs to find out about. It may have been these individuals, very much aligned to the Catholic Vatican, who actually funded the Illuminati. A lot of people find this hard to believe, because on paper, the Illuminati, you see, is an order that's meant to be anti-religious or anti-monarchical. They're meant to be against Catholic religion, Christianity, and against monarchy. But, of course, this is one of their famous, you know, ruses to throw people off the scent.
Wow. So where did the Nephilim come in?
Where do they come in? Well, see, the Nephilim is just a biblical term for what I believe is the visitations, you know, in many, many millennia ago to this planet. This all ties into the whole idea of how come it is that man is so technically advanced? How come, you know, he's so emotionally arrested? How could he have had so many incredible inventions, you know, about 7,000 to 11,000 years ago, and they don't seem to have any antecedent stages? You know, basically all the anomalies, you know, can be accounted, you have to account for them in some way. And science and religion have had thousands of years to account for these anomalies, and they've done a terrible job. I mean, they're legends in their own mind, and they think they've done a marvelous job. But as we, the human race, become more literate and more sane and more rational. And now that we're able to read, you know, and study for ourselves in the last, you know, couple of hundred years, it hasn't been a very long time that we've been able to do that. But now, since there has been an explosion of interest, an explosion of, writing and libraries, the human race is smarter than it was before. So we want answers, and we've not been given those answers by the officialdom, but we have been given the answers in mythology. In the mythologies and legends of the world, there are plenty of answers as to what was going on in ancient times, and that there was these great civilizations, and the myths and legends also talk about how they were destroyed. And they also talk about the visitation of fantastically advanced, you know, beings who mixed their DNA with our DNA, that they crossed over, you know, they involved themselves in these experiments which tampered with the DNA, the biology, and that also means the consciousness of the pre-visitation individuals here. And these are not Neanderthals or anybody that's been put before us now, because, of course, that's a big lie that's been invented afterwards to account for the pre-visitation era. So these are basically off-world beings that visited this planet and have been steering the destiny of the planet. None of those people are alive themselves originally. Their original fallen angels don't, you know, they're not alive, let's say, but their descendants, every one of the human race that they have interfered with, every single person you know carries the alien DNA. And in fact, just the last month or so, it's been now basically confirmed from scientific point of view that this DNA exists.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Are they from the planet that was called the Second Sun?
No, they're not from there. The Second Sun was a euphemism used for a very large body in our own solar system that got destroyed after these people start basically interfered with us. Their entrance into our solar system also involved a war, a skirmish in the skies that was seen from Earth, and it very much traumatized the people that were on the Earth. And it's from those days of watching these flashes in the sky and the thunderings in the sky that the whole mythologies come of the warring gods, especially in Scandinavian mythology, but all over the Native American Indian mythologies, they talk about the flashes and thunderings, you know, in the sky, and that the gods are angry. Mm-hmm. Well, this is actually because they witnessed a tremendous tumult in the sky, which resulted in the destruction of a very large planet that used to be part of our solar system. And there's been all sorts of disinformation that's been, you know, put out there to try and cover up the existence of this body. But, of course, scientists sort of shot themselves in the foot, because it was a scientist called Bode, famous Bode's Law. You know, their own science proved that there was a missing planet out there, that there should be another planet between Mars and Jupiter. Then we have the phenomenon of the asteroid belt, which is the remains of a planet. Charles Fort, you know, the American researcher, discovered that all of these strange rains of frogs and fishes and salt water and ice and oil and all sorts of debris that periodically falls to the Earth, especially at the times of great storms. You know, where's all that coming from? So again, there's never any serious answering to all of this, but it turns out that this is part of the remains of an enormous planet that was destroyed in ancient times about 50,000 years ago. And, you know, our planet is still reeling from the shock of that destruction.
Now, could that have also caused one of the ice ages? Because couldn't that throw? Couldn't that even?
Was that connected to the ice ages? Well, first of all, there was no ice age. The ice age is a phenomenon that was part of what they call the Pleistocene epoch, which was a 2 million year geological epoch. And just in the last 10 years, there's been now counter evidence to show that there was no such thing as the Pleistocene epoch. Well, my goodness, if that isn't, the whole world should be talking about that.
Yeah, that's.
And the men who discovered this are the top geologists and anthropologists in Oxford and Cambridge universities.
Why don't we hear any of this stuff?
Because, my God, this would shake the foundations, every lie that we've been told. The one thing that science cannot ever stand, is if one of their own, you know, sacred cows, a big one, is leveled. Now, of course, they have been leveled. They don't mind a couple of mavericks, you know, writing a book or, you know, sort of saying something against them. Because those people, they can all easily ostracize. Mm-hmm. The Velikovskys, the Beaumonts, you see, even the Michael Tesarians, they're not worried about people like us because, you know, we can be silenced or, you know, nobody's going to listen to us. The one thing that they cannot stand is the top brass from within their own totem pole you know, from MIT, from CIT, from Oxford, from Cambridge, from, you know, the top universities, coming out and refuting their sacred cows. And this is exactly what has been done. So they must then keep that quiet.
Yeah.
But as a matter of fact, these individuals showed that there was ice action in the world. There's definitely been ice drift, which has caused some of the geological formations. But that icing, that permafrost, was created by superheating first. And these new geologists, these people, have been able to show exactly how that works, that through volcanism, volcanoes, earthquakes, you see, the superheating of the atmosphere, and a lot of them can't even account for how that happened. But they say that if the atmosphere of the Earth was superheated, then, of course, the radical cooling from that immediate blasting of heat will create ice action on the Earth. So you will definitely register ice action and catastrophe from ice, but it is not an ice age per se. And this is what I go into very deeply on the DVD that I made on the Atlantis, the DVD that goes with the Atlantis book, because I talk about this extensively, about the new kind of science that has come to prove that this ice age phenomena is just completely nonsensical.
Wow.
And the planet Tiamat's destruction very much could have had something to do with this, because the change of the gravitational pull would have affected the tectonic plates, causing enormous friction and volcanism. It would have helped to heat up the atmosphere of the Earth, and also the Roche limit, which is a sort of a barrier around our Earth, would have also been superheated. And this could have easily precipitated boiling magma and all sorts of phenomena, and the result of that, a symptom of that, is ice action.
Yeah, it's kind of what I was thinking, that how could it not affect the Earth in some way, a whole planet, you know, relatively close, blowing up, how could it not affect?
People say the moon could be part of Tiamat, a breakaway part of Tiamat. People say the moon was not as close to us, even in the history of the Maya. They've worked out that the Maya referred to the moon as being much further away and much smaller. The evidence is there for all this strange debris that's hanging around our ionosphere and also in the asteroid belt, you know. So, but, you know, again, we don't even need to turn to science. I'm a person who doesn't even bother looking to what they say. You just go back to the mythologies, and they're telling you how it might be in a bit of a poetic language and so on, but they're telling you clearly about what happened, the ferocity. You know, we have lengthy tracts from different sacred texts. This is what I go into the Atlantis book, showing that the ancients knew full well that there was a war of the gods and that this caused enormous tribulation morally. It changed people's diet. It shortened the lifespan because it changed the growing cycles of the Earth, and that the Earth changed from what was known as vir perpetuum, the perpetual spring, into, you know, a changing climate, radically changed. The topography was changed, and this affected the diet instantaneously, so that in a few hundred years, they say people's biologies radically changed. The behavior of animals has changed, you know. It's about looking at all the information from biology and anthropology and paleontology and mythology and history, and then it takes a mind to be able to connect it all together. We may be newly literate, but still some of us, and most of us in the world, have not developed the pattern recognition. We can barely read and write, and we haven't developed the capacity for synthetic thought, using the right brain, using the imagination, to connect all of the different phenomena. People are still very fearful of knowledge. People still have a very tunnel vision on a thing. People still rely on a teacher to tell them what to believe. No. The teacher's job is just to bring you the information. I don't know where we got this idea that the teacher's there to tell you what to believe.
Yeah.
This is exactly what we have now. No, a teacher's job is anyone that brings you some information for your perusal.
Now,
period.
I was thinking about this, and maybe you can clarify. Could this new planet X that they've suddenly discovered, could that be the missing planet of the Sumerians?
No, I think that's mostly disinformation.
Okay.
One of the greatest areas of disinformation, and I could be wrong, but I believe that this planet Nibiru and all of this planet X is another ruse, so that when people get into studying what I'm talking about, they often get sidetracked into the studying of the planet X phenomena, which is, I believe, a carefully concocted, but again, apparently a sound scientific thing, which will bamboozle people who are into astronomy and science and get them very interested. And so people go charging after that, you know, but there's no real corroboration in any other mythology. This is one of the things you have to realize, is that some of these theories that come out of, you know, say one area are not corroborated in all the other mythologies. I try to deal with the mythologies that are very much, dispersion. There's an element of dispersion there that you'll find a very similar refrain in, say, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 other mythologies of the world. Now, the Nibiru thing sounds almighty interesting, and it's meant to come out of Sumerian Babylonian mythology, but the problem is it's not confirmed in any other kind of mythology in the world, so that made me suspicious. Whereas the destruction of Tiamat and the tumult and the idea of a careering comet, perhaps, that turns out to be in hundreds of legends, you know, corroborated all over the world.
Yeah, and what a way to get you, you know, not thinking about that, to get you into a different direction.
Right. Well, I mean, as I say, you know, a lot of the science world, a lot of these institutions are controlled by very, very smart people who want to delay. I think they know that eventually the human race is going to crack it. But they'd like to delay that, you know, denouement as long as possible. So the way to do that is to keep throwing sand in your eyes and to also, you know, get you to follow all the glitters is not gold, as they say, but, you know, to get you to follow all of these false leads. It's one of the ways to slow down the progress of discovery. The researcher in this field has to be highly discriminating.
And be able to think with both parts of the brain.
Yes, absolutely right.
Yeah. So what was the great sin?
The great sin that is being spoken of in the Bible is something that happened, you know, many thousands of years before the Bible was written. But still in the Bible, we can get we are actually being told, amazingly, you know, inaccurate. And, of course, if you include then, if you add to reading the Bible about the sin, if you go into the uncanonical works, the apocryphal works, the Book of Enoch, then you start to get a picture that, wait a minute, it's not just this thing of the fall. It has nothing to do with Eve. It's not to do with the angels accompanying women, you know, in a sort of a sexual way that they believe that the Jewish rabbis and scholars will say that, look, man may have fallen from heaven, but man may have also been seduced by the evil one. Then the uncanonical books are telling us, yes, he was seduced by the evil one, and he was also biologically tampered with by the evil ones, meaning that there was some sort of a sexual, you know, mating or coupling with the earth women. And that's about as far as the majority of the world scholars have got. To say that the angels, you know, accompanied with women is still radical enough from a Christian point of view. These documents were once considered part of the Christian, you know, scriptures. They were akin to them. And therefore, a lot of Christians and Jews do accept that there was a presence here of the sons of men, the sons of God, the angels, you know, the fallen angels. But that's about as far as most people have got. I go a lot further than that and say it actually was not just the physical accompanying of men and women, or gods and women, because many of the other books that were never part of the Bible, many of these other, like I said, if you cross-reference it with Babylonian and Sumerian, you see, and Egyptian texts, you start to find out that there was something more than that. You start to find out, in fact, that this sexual coupling didn't work, and that they had to go one step further than that. And there's even statements to the fact that the sexual coupling did not work, and that the children that were born from these, you know, liaisons were hideous in the extreme, and that even the mothers died at childbirth and so on. So I believe that the real sin constitutes the next step, George, which was that these highly intelligent off-world beings started then to go one step further to actually work on a much higher level than that, than just normal intercourse, and they went further to actually tamper with the DNA of the human beings. They had this ability, they had this skill.
The first genetic experiments.
Yeah, like some sort of hideous Planet of the Apes experiment that people, again, would find very far-fetched because, of course, you know, yeah, this is something that's meant to be only discovered today, you know, and people who have no historical understanding whatsoever and who don't know how to read between the lines of the mythologies of the world, they believe this is something that's just been, you know, discovered 5 minutes ago. Well, people are going to have to wake up and discover this is many thousands of years old.
So now, are the Elohim from Lemuria?
The Elohim is I take the word. The word is pretty much nobody has a real consensus on the word at all. So I kind of take a liberty and say that I believe that it could be that if we wanted, just for argument's sake, to say that the Yahwistic, Jehovah's, you know, concept is more of an Atlantean, you know, image of God, and that the Elohim, which means the many gods, or the ones chosen from the many gods, or a lot of people have also said that the Elohim could mean the feminine aspect of God. And I like that. I like that a lot, that concept.
Mm-hmm.
So I then tie that in with the, you know, the Lemurian race, who were a group of people that were much more aligned spiritually. And even though they were also the equal of the science They had the intelligence of the Nephilim, and they were descended from the Nephilim. They also honored the human DNA part of us. But that's just my take on it. I would not argue with a biblical scholar or anything like that this is the case. It's just, you know, then you'd be splitting hairs about the meaning of the word, and there's a different, you know, there's an Aramaic translation of Elohim, there's a, you know, Greek translation, there's the Hebrew translation, you know. It's just I deal more connotatively there, because the Yahwistic connotation of God is a very masculine one. It's a very anti-feminine one. Mm-hmm. You know, for instance, in the synagogues, you see women were never allowed. And there's even an old Talmudic statement that says that, you know, ten men make a synagogue. You have to have 10 men in order to conjure the presence of God in the synagogue. And there's an old Talmudic statement that if you have 9 men and 1,000,000 women, you still couldn't convene in the synagogue, because women are nothing after all.
Wow.
Okay, so we have, this is this Yahwistic tendency, which I trace back to the time of the Atlanteans. That's something that came into our existence from the tampering with the DNA. And then I take the liberty of saying, well then, wait, if this Elohim, if it does in fact represent the more feminine aspect of God, if it incorporates the Sophia aspect, if it incorporates the idea that there are many gods or many aspects of one God, then this would definitely be, you know, something that I believe would tie in with what the Lemurians, for the short time that they were around, were trying to also teach.
Right. Okay, we're going to take another break here. When we come back, I want to ask you about the Anukai.
Okay.
Here is Spirit of the West and Time to Ring Some Changes. Enjoy.